This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 17 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
Today, we're going to be talking about a phrase made famous by an Italian Nobel Prize winner. And it actually links back to our last episode when we were discussing the origin of life, not only on Earth, but in the cosmos. But that's all I'm going to say right now, drawing a little bit of tension here until after our update segment. So, Steve, what have you got for us today?
Well, Tim, the private venture Blue Ghost lunar lander has failed. And not only did it fall over, so too did Firefly Aerospace's market share. Based in Cedar Park, Texas, the company has a somewhat sleazy origin, since one of its founders used to be with Virgin Galactic and allegedly left that company bringing proprietary technical secrets with him. A second update is with regard to the secret Boeing X-37B unmanned spacecraft operated by the United States Space Force. This seventh mission, known as OTV-7, ended on March 7th after 434 days in space, and there were three notable achievements during this mission. For the first time ever, a photo was released from orbit showing its payload bay doors open with the full Earth in the background. And this illustrates its second accomplishment of attaining a high Earth orbit, which is some 38,800 kilometers away from the Earth. And we should note that the space station's low Earth orbit is a mere 420 kilometers above the Earth. And you know what, Tim? That's closer than the distance from Salmon Arm to Vancouver. Oh, well. Its third accomplishment was its aerobraking maneuver, designed to use atmospheric drag to alter the spacecraft orbit with minimal fuel consumption. Now, this maneuver could revolutionize how future spacecraft adjust their trajectories rather than relying on expending large amounts of fuel. And speaking of payloads, for OTV-7, Space Force has only revealed that the X-37B was carrying NASA's SEEDS experiment, which was to explore what happens to plant seeds when they're exposed to the harsh radiation environment of long-duration spaceflight. However, the X-37B's highly secretive operation has fueled speculation about its true purpose, with some experts suggesting it could be a prototype for future military space missions. The growing rivalry between the US and China adds another layer of intrigue, especially since China also tested its own reusable spacecraft and it landed after orbiting for 8 months. Okay, enough of that.
Well, you bet. Let's get on to it. So here we go. It's about the Fermi paradox, which, well, we've mentioned it in the past. And of course, it begs the question, who's Fermi? Enrico Fermi was the gifted Italian nuclear physicist who was awarded in 1938 the Nobel Prize in Physics. So he was a wise man, obviously, and he could begin to see with the rise of the fascist Italian Benito Mussolini that he might be better off leaving Italy, and he did. So he got that prize in Stockholm, and a few months later, he and his family secretly sailed to New York in December of that year, 1938, where they applied for permanent residency.
And there, Fermi was in instant demand to work in various fields of nuclear physics, and he's renowned for being the creator of the world's first nuclear reactor, and subsequently was a significant physicist at the Manhattan Project. However, his scant portrayal in the Oppenheimer movie was probably unnoticed by most, but there's no mistaking the fact Fermi has been called the architect of the nuclear age.
So that's our introduction to Enrico Fermi. But our interest today isn't so much in his nuclear prowess, but rather an unusual and astute observation he made, rather casually actually, in the summer of 1950. Now, by this time, he was employed at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, conducting research on developing newer and better atomic weapons. How nice is that? That aside, though, one day during lunch with a couple of his nuclear colleagues, Fermi discussed the current state of UFO reports and the likelihood of intelligent life beyond Earth. Now, mind you, he wasn't just walking around with a couple of janitors or something. No, he was hanging out with his, well, his peers, other brainiacs, you might say.
Exactly. So, Tim, on that particular day, he was discussing with three colleagues, Edward Teller, father of the hydrogen bomb, Herbert York, another key figure in nuclear weapons development, and the first director of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and Emil Konopinski, a Polish atomic physicist who investigated the possibility of a hydrogen bomb igniting the Earth's atmosphere, a scenario eventually deemed highly unlikely. Now, as you mentioned, Tim, part of their casual conversation was with regard to the contemporary UFO reports, which were rampant at the time, and they also discussed the possibility of faster-than-light travel. And given the vast number of stars in the galaxy, many of them much older than the Sun, and the vast number of possible habitable planets, Fermi asked, if extraterrestrial civilizations exist, where are they?
Well, it's a casual question, and it was later expanded into what is now known as the Fermi paradox. And we know that a paradox is a statement which seems impossible or at least difficult to understand because it contains two opposite facts. And with regard to the Fermi's paradox, it's this contradiction, right? It's, you know, the high probability of intelligent alien life existing, but on the other hand, a complete lack of any observable evidence in the form of signals or visits or any remnant artifacts.
After Fermi's premature death in 1954, the paradox was expanded upon in 1961 by Dr. Frank Drake, who began his career as a radio astronomer, studying the planets in our solar system, and later branching into studying pulsars, and then searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. In November 1961, the National Academy of Sciences approached Drake to conduct a small, informal, three-day SETI conference at the Green Bank Observatory to quantify if there was a reasonable chance of successfully detecting civilizations around other stars. Drake presented an equation which estimated the number of active extraterrestrial civilizations in the Milky Way by considering seven factors, such as the rate of star formation, the fraction of stars with planets, the number of habitable planets, and the likelihood of intelligent life evolving. His equation was meant to be only a stepping stone to determine if continuing with SETI and its funding was viable, nothing more. However, to some, the Drake equation has since been described as, quote, the second most famous equation in science after E equals mc squared. But that's entirely up to debate. You just ask any physicist about Schrodinger's or Heisenberg's quantum equations, but I digress.
Okay, so using Drake's initial values, scientists estimated that there were detectable civilizations in the Milky Way ranging between a number of 1,000 and 100 million, which of course is a pretty enormous range. But since that time, the value of the seven variables which constitute the Drake equation, well, they've been reevaluated based on new information and astronomical observations. For example, the original equation estimated that each star would have between one and five stars in its habitable zone, but now that number has been downsized to under half. Drake had originally assumed that for every planet which did have life, it would evolve into intelligent life, and that number has also been reduced by a factor of 1,000. Drake's optimistic number of Milky Way civilizations is now estimated to be only in the hundreds to thousands, with the most recent conservative number citing a mere 36 active alien civilizations.
And who of our age, Tim, can forget Carl Sagan opening our consciousness to the vastness of the cosmos and the challenges of interstellar communication? Much lesser known is astronomer and author Michael Hart, who in 1975 published a detailed examination of the Fermi paradox entitled An Explanation for the Absence of Extraterrestrials on Earth. Hart's work has since become a theoretical reference point for much of the research into what is now sometimes known as the Fermi-Hart paradox. Yes, that's a slight change to the title, because although Fermi first posed the question, it's Hart who first applied rigorous analysis to the problem, showing it not to be a trivial matter. However, for the sake of simplicity, we're going to continue to simply use the term Fermi paradox. Now, Tim, before we examine the scholarly responses to the paradox, what's your layman's explanation for the lack of alien signals?
Well, first, you're saying I'm not scholarly and I'm a layman, but I'll take that. So for starters, I actually do believe the galaxy and the universe are full of life, and likely quite advanced civilizations have existed and do exist on millions of planets. Even random asteroids that have been snagged by NASA recently have found the building blocks of life. But that only makes Fermi's paradox that much more intriguing. And of course, he's right to ask that question. So where is everybody? Now, I know it might sound a little bit trite to say this, to answer your question, Steve, but I think we aren't looking in the right ways. At a simplistic level, we're using the tools that are available to us in the 21st century. And just look at how far those have advanced in the past 50 years, going from land-based observations to the James Webb Telescope, which of course is operating in space. I'd have to think that more advanced civilizations have discovered or invented far more powerful means to communicate over great distances and use technology that we simply don't have. Steve, how about you? What's your take?
Well, first of all, I sort of understand what you're saying there. So let's say that 60 years ago, they were sending us emails, and emails didn't exist here on Earth. Oh, okay. Well, I kind of like what I call the blasé Sunday picnic theory, Tim. And by this, I mean millions of years ago, a group of advanced alien travelers stopped by Earth for a picnic, had a washroom break, took a few pictures, and returned from whence they came, whereupon they notified their somewhat less than stellar travel agent complaining, "Well, thanks for nothing, that wasn't anything special." And Earth was removed from a list of favorable destinations.
We got dissed by a travel agent. Okay. Well, let's stack up our unabashedly non-scientific viewpoints with some actual scholarly responses.
Well, Tim, we've dabbled with our own fanciful explanations. Now let's examine some accepted scientific thoughts. First, there's what is called the rare Earth hypothesis, which simply states we are special. Complex life forms may be extremely rare, and we're lucky enough to have unique Goldilocks conditions, such as a stable star, which doesn't shower us with deadly gamma and X-rays, a large moon, a protective magnetic field, plate tectonics, and the right chemical compositions.
Now, I know that Tina Turner song, "What's Love Got to Do with It?" And I could sing a few bars, but so what's the moon got to do with this?
Well, there are a number of lunar factors which benefit us. First, the moon stabilizes the Earth's axial tilt of 23.5 degrees, which is responsible for our seasons. This stability prevents extreme shifts, which would cause chaotic climatic changes. Mars, for example, wobbles between 0 and 60 degrees, and that leads to extreme weather shifts, making life much harder to sustain. Secondly, the moon gradually slows Earth's rotation due to tidal friction, which over billions of years has led to longer days here on the Earth, and that creates a more stable life form. When Earth first formed, a day lasted only 6 hours.
So, looking at all the impact craters, we can also see that those asteroids would have been pummeling the Earth. And of course, that would have caused havoc, if nothing else, to life forms. And we're not just talking about, well, ancient history. Let's just see here. Between February 2017 and August 2023, the European Space Agency funded something called NEOLIOTA. It's a project that stands for Near Earth Object Lunar Impacts and Optical Transients Analysis. And it detected 192 validated lunar impact flashes. Thank you, Mr. Moon.
Exactly. Earth's iron core and its subsequent magnetic field protects us from the sun's radioactive solar wind. and the Earth's tectonic activity helps regulate the temperature by cycling carbon between the atmosphere, oceans, and the Earth's interior. And finally, on this point, even if microbial life is common, intelligent life might be extraordinarily rare. I think it's fair to say that a lot of species living in our oceans are intelligent, and that includes all fishes, cephalopods, and mammals such as dolphins and whales. And yet, we've never detected a single marine invention, not even the wheel.
Okay, Steve, get your tongue out of your cheek. I've got another reason why you're not talking to an alien to co-host Space Talks. This one is predicated on species starting out life in some kind of organic form, like us Earthlings. But as things progress to space travel potential, the rigors of space seem to overmatch the potential of a life form developed on the ground or in an ocean. And the solution becomes a post-biological existence. How would you like some of that, Steve?
You know, Tim, I've already got a batch of anatomical aids, and what you're suggesting is already sort of being talked about. Now, I'm going to use the term cloud, as I think most listeners have a pretty good idea as to what that means. The digitization of information and memories and experiences already exists in the form of pictures, sounds, and videos as data residing on computer chips and hard drives. So what do you think is the next step?
Well, we can do better than magnetic ink these days. How about transferring everything on your brain's hard drive to a chip? You know, a durable one. And if you want to experience time travel, discovering brave new worlds, and maybe even naming them after your friends and sponsors, it might be a whole lot better to do that from the comfort of your own mainframe.
Sounds not only interesting, but tangible in the near future, let's say. But what happens when my data file arrives at some exotic beach on a pristine exoplanet far, far from here? Do we beam up a living creature from the planet and then transfer my ones and twos to that creature's brain? Well, if that's the case, other life forms may have done so here, and they walk among us as in the third rock from the Sun TV series.
I don't know, Steve, but what if they turned us into cone heads so that we fit in? I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Well, one of the most favorite theories deals with what is called the Great Filter, in that something stops civilizations from contacting us or advancing on their own. One such filter is the premise that life rarely evolves to intelligence due to catastrophic challenges, such as difficulty in transitioning from simple to complex cells, or natural events wiping out emerging higher forms of life. Apparently, this happened on Earth about 900,000 years ago, during the mid-Pleistocene transition of natural climatic change. The number of modern humanity's ancestors were reduced to a breeding population of barely 1,300 individuals in a devastating bottleneck that nearly brought us to the brink of annihilation. Another filter states that all technical civilizations go extinct before reaching technological maturity. And for us, we know that could very well happen if World War III breaks out. And according to Albert Einstein, should that happen, any survivors will fight World War IV with sticks and stones. And a final filter is that technologically advanced civilizations attain maturity but don't want to reach out.
I suppose that being the case, those civilizations might be very happy developing their own world and just be content with their way of life, and actually see no need to expand their horizons. But I've got another explanation for the lack of space travelers showing up at our door, and that's fear. Now, this is an explanation that's the cornerstone of all those sci-fi movies and, well, franchises like Alien. In Hollywood, no sooner do you wander into deep space than you find yourself under attack by horrible, horrible creatures. The Syrian students of this question refer to it as the dark forest hypothesis. Now, care to guess how this metaphor works, Steve?
I'll try to give it a go, but I'm not going to start off with a description of the forest, dark or otherwise. Any successful species is going to have to consume energy to survive, and more broadly speaking, consume resources. And the laws of entropy are not specific to Earth, and also apply everywhere in the cosmos, meaning deterioration and decay are inevitable, and that will require constant renewal. And that means continually using not only energy, but resources. Earth's history of exploration was always in search of those two commodities, and we can't imagine spacefaring aliens to be a little different in their quest. And as you pointed out, this is the theme of any number of TV shows and movies, not the least being Tom Cruise's Oblivion, where Earth's oceans are being drained by aliens. And the twist being here is that these aliens aren't living organisms. They're digital entities, and that's a tip of the hat to your post-biological posit. And maybe these space travelers arrive with a do-no-harm credo. Maybe they don't. And that's where the forest metaphor comes into play. If you become aware of the likelihood or even certainty of the existence of other species, the one thing you can't be sure of is their degree of friendliness. Given that simple truth, maybe the best and only survival technique is to stay hidden in the dark forest and never set foot into the open.
Sounds like a good idea to me. Now here's a solid bit of reasoning for this one then. The more space travelers one encounters, the more likely you are to find a bad egg, a nasty bit of homework, you might say. From the standpoint of an advanced life form looking for those resources you mentioned, Steve, it makes sense that you would be looking where other life forms abound, since they also would surely have need for plentiful resources. So that's where they're going to go look. They're going to look where the fish are, as they say.
I haven't caught a fish in my life. Well, another reason why we haven't found signs of alien life is due to cosmic isolation. That is, the immense vastness of the universe precludes detection of other civilizations. For example, the average distance between stars is 5 light years. To the casual listener, the number 5 seems reasonably attainable, but let's examine that in a bit more detail. The fastest speed ever obtained by a human-made object is 700,000 kilometers per hour, just recently, by the Parker Space Probe. And to go 5 light-years distance at that speed would take 77,300 years, and that's one way. Our closest star, Proxima Centauri, is some 4.5 light-years away and does have exoplanets, but this particular red dwarf star sends out immense periodic solar flares, negating the likelihood of life. So, the next exoplanet system is Ross 128b, which is 11 light-years away. And that means a one-way travel would take 169,000 years. So, just think of the ramifications of that. And just for earthly reference, Voyager 1, which was launched in 1977 and is traveling at a speed of 61,000 kilometers per hour, is only, get your paper and pencils out, 0.0026 light years away, and won't be just over half a light year away for another 10,000 years. Voyager 1, which carries messages from Earth and diagrams of how to reach us, will reach the first exoplanet perhaps capable of supporting life some 220,000 years from now.
Wow, that's all I can say. Considering how much we've advanced in 500 years since the scientific revolution, I can't even imagine what advancements might occur in 300,000 years if we're still on the planet or existing as a species for that matter.
Absolutely. Now, with regard to radio and TV transmissions, they do travel at the speed of light, which means, Tim, that our first episodes of Space Talk is still 8 years away from reaching Ross 128b, and the signal strength will be immensely weak. However, should it be detected, an intelligent civilization would have to pinpoint the source and, if interested, send a reply, and that would take 11 years to get here. And if we thought that regular mail, which is derisively called snail mail, was slow, imagine 22 years between messages.
Well, Steve, let me expand on the impracticality, or in fact, impossibility of interstellar space travel. And I've got really nice suitcases tucked away under the stairs here, the same place where I keep lots of stuff I don't use anymore. You know, bread makers, rice cookers, that sort of thing. The point is that some ideas that used to sound great, well, they don't age well. like, for instance, interstellar travel. Now, you've mentioned the staggering distances in terms of Earth years, and along the way, no matter how fast you fly, you're passing through an endless landscape of radiation, of the sort that takes a toll on carbon-based life. So this is a particularly good reason to explain the shortage of visitors here on Earth. Space travel sucks. And it's what I'm going to be calling the pumpkin dust in the wind theorem.
Tim, I honestly have no idea how that's going to pan out.
Well, let's just say this. You're heading out on your fancy new spacecraft. It's packed to the gunnels. In fact, there's only one place to put that special 100-pound pumpkin you want to take with you on the road. You tie it to the roof. Now, initially, things go pretty well. And after a year, there's only been a tiny bit of atomic erosion from particles chipping away at the pumpkin. Perhaps as little as 5 grams are lost. Then after 10 years, there's some outgassing and decomposition. There goes another 5 grams. Hey, 100 years later, the molecular breakdown is beginning to add up and we lose another 50 grams. And early in our travels, say after 1,000 years, the radiation damage adds up and the pumpkin starts to become very brittle. Finally, here's the bad news. As we look up and see the pumpkin has finally succumbed to cosmic rays and become space dust. And that's just 10,000 years into the trip. So those of an age might remember the refrain of that song by the group Kansas. All we are is pumpkin dust in the wind.
Oh, you had to reach for that one. You know, watching that pumpkin dissolve might be bad enough. But what if you realize you've forgotten the pumpkin pie plate and just can't bear substitutes? So you turn the ship around, return to Earth. Presumably the whole time you've been in some kind of stasis, but the folks back at home haven't been. You've traveled 20,000 years, and what do you find? Well, I'll tell you one thing. That pretty girl that you left behind at the launch party didn't wait.
Good point. Although I think her last words might have been, "Hey, don't forget the pumpkin pie plate."
As you mentioned, one way to remedy long time periods would be some kind of stasis for thousands of years, relying on technology and luck to keep your biometric data intact, and hoping that nothing in 10,000 years would go wrong. Good luck with that.
There's one explanation that I think makes a great deal of sense, and that is to question just how long any civilization can exist without coming up against an extinction-level event. So, a lot of things have to go the right way for a very long period of time for a civilization to reach the point where interstellar space travel becomes viable.
Clearly, environmental disasters will come into play for some. Think of our dinosaurs, for example, which, from a biological point of view, have been far more successful in living on our planet. They existed for 165 million years. In comparison, Homo sapiens have only been around for about 100,000 years.
Okay, finally, here's a good one. The risk of artificial intelligence. Now, we're already starting to become reliant on AI, and to my knowledge, we have not adequately taken the time to consider the ethical and safety aspects of what's to come. Why wouldn't that be true on other planets with other life forms? We've all come from some organic history that's evolved to suit the conditions of the planet we live on, and it's reasonable to imagine that it's going to take a lot of AI to help any species survive in the context of interstellar space travel. So I'll even throw in a current day reference to the dangers of AI. Now, we're on the eve of a federal election, and a recent report from CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, has said that three countries, Russia, China, and Iran, will almost certainly employ AI trying to undermine our democracy during this election. So, relatively speaking, we're in the very first days of AI, and already it's being used to destabilize democracy.
Well, Tim, there's been some sort of life on Earth for billions of years, and no single species has survived for more than a minute or two set against the breadth of time, which is something to ponder.
Certainly is. But speaking of time, that's all the time we have today on Space Talks. And as always, we hope that if nothing else, we provided some food for thought, in this case, about the Fermi paradox. So until next time, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?